Chumba.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here! Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I have been asked many, many times to, because I did the review of Margin Call, my favourite financial movie, I've been asked many, many times to cover The Big Short. And, well, if it is demanded, then so I shall provide. This is going to be my review of The Big Short and a little, well, actually, it's mostly an explanation of what went on using the movie as a prop, but, you know, gets us to the same place. Right, now, before we go into the movie itself, which you can buy on YouTube or presumably a whole bunch of other places, Prime and whatever. Before we get into that, I thought let's give a few minutes just on the background of what led up to it, because it was a kind of perfect storm of factors that led into it. I want to start the story. You could start the story at a number of places, but I want to start it in 1997, 1998, the Asian financial crisis. This was basically a whole bunch of Asian economies and Russia racking up far too much debt, a bit like the Western world is today. And the Western world doesn't seem to have any problem with it because it seems to think, debt crises is what happens to other countries, not us. But anyway, the Asians got there first. That blew up rather nastily. And emerging economies, Asian economies, they started thinking, okay, well, let's keep our money in the US because that would obviously be better. And it basically started to channel a whole load of money towards the US, that sloshes around and ultimately ends up in houses, in mortgages, because it's got to go somewhere. That's the route that it went. It was the path of least resistance for a whole bunch of reasons, regulatory reasons, cultural reasons, and so on. So massive glut of capital comes into the US, starts to push houses higher from about 99, 2000 onwards. I remember this is just when I was getting into out of university and starting to look for a house. And just every year, houses just went up and up and up. Same in the US, same across the Western world. The next prelude point would have to be the dot-com crisis, that was the thing that was crashing just as I came into finance. NASDAQ lost 78% of its value in a very short order. And the key thing from our point of view is that Alan Greenspan, who was the Treasury Secretary at the time, he decided, okay, the solution to this problem is if we make money really, really cheap. And so he slashed interest rates down to 1%, did a whole bunch of things that gave rise to a cheap money environment. Where if you've got cheap money, people leverage up, they take on more debt, they don't worry about the interest cost of all of this stuff. Again, sounds very familiar to the crisis that is brewing right now in the Western world. And the Fed basically decided, yeah, rather than deal fundamentally with the dot-com crisis, rather than, have a genuine clear out and a reset of the system, we're just going to paper over the cracks and we're just going to get the party started again. Probably a bad idea. The next prelude to it is going to have to be a whole bunch of policies, largely in the Clinton era. What did they have? They had an affordable housing market bill, something like agenda, whatever. And they set these, what do they call them, GSE standards, which basically led to a race to the bottom in who was eligible to get money for a house. It had always been the case that banks were incentivized to lend money to people who could actually pay it back. Now, for the younger members of my audience, that might seem a bizarre concept, only lending money to people who could actually pay it back. But that is genuinely how the financial world used to work at one time. So Clinton came along and he was like, no, we want immigrants and people from disadvantaged backgrounds, however that is defined, to be able to buy a house, even if they can't afford it. Don't let a little thing like them not being able to afford it stop them from buying a house. So they did, was it CRA enforcements for the other thing they did? There was loads of pressure to reduce racial inequality in who was getting a house, because, of course, the only reason why people with different levels of melanin might not own a house is nothing to do with their propensity to pay what they owe. It must be racism on behalf of the banks. So that was all, well, with social engineering through the markets, effectively. I'll also flag securitization rule changes. So the Fed and the SEC basically changed how quickly a financial institution could basically shift something off their books. Why does this matter? It's because if you make a loan and you have to sit with it for a number of years, you're going to be careful about that loan not being shit. But if you can ship it on to somebody else, somebody who looked less closely at it, the ability of the underlying to pay than you did, well, you don't care. And actually, if you can make a turn by doing that, suddenly you're thinking, ooh, what I can do is I can just go and do a whole load of dodgy deals, package them up, ship them on, make some money, do it again. Why do I care if the underlying is dodgy? And so that started to lead to, well, a boom in mortgages and lending and debt-fueled investing. You've got to remember the demographics are changing at this time as well. Boomers are a big generation, and they are just starting, some of them, the earliest retirees, are starting to retire at this time. And certainly you know that there's going to be a lot more of them retiring over the coming years. Pension funds need yield. They need income. And mortgage-backed securities look like the perfect mechanism for doing this, so that provided it as well. And actually, one other factor that I might as well throw in is the perceived safety, which was a product of the rising liquidity throughout this era. I mean, I talk about liquidity a lot at the moment because it's becoming particularly acute. We got into these liquidity cycles. Actually, they really started around the dot-com bubble. You got on this 4 to 8 year cycle of liquidity surging up and down. Started in 2008 and it looked, sorry, started in 2000. And then every 4 to 8 years, every 4 years, you have some kind of blow up. And quite often every 8 years, you have a much bigger blow up. That was happening. Banks were deploying VAR model, value at risk models, which were basically telling them that everything looks good because your value at risk is manageable. Basel II regulations, might as well throw that in, that encouraged holding safe investments. What do they define as safe investments? Government debt and mortgages. So you've got a whole bunch of factors, not blunt, because this film very much focuses on, oh, the banks are bad. Yes, but the government also, the reason I ran through that whole list is because the government did a mountain of stupid shit that then allowed the banks and set the condition for the banks to do what the banks do, which is to make a turn on it, because you've created a system where they would basically be stupid not to do it. Right, now we need to move on to, before we get into playing any video clips, this story is not going to make any sense unless I explain the financial products that go into it. Now, I remember doing a whole bunch of financial exams in my youth, a whole bloody load of them. And I didn't realise it at the time, but this movie, The Big Short, has explained to me that the way that you get across explaining complex financial products is to have Margot Robbie in a state of undress, which seems obvious in retrospect. But I didn't know that at the time, but who am I to question financial orthodoxy? on this particular occasion. So here we go. Here's Margot Robbie in a state of undress. We are going to use that to explain mortgage-backed securities, just like they do in the movie. I'm not going to use her explanation because it wasn't very good, but mine is better. So basically, you got a mortgage, you know what that is. The bank, you sell the bank a mortgage contract is technically the way it works, but okay, fine, the bank sells you a mortgage or whatever. And you then pay them money every month. And depending on the type of borrower you are, you have got, you know, good capital behind you, good job, very industrious, very conscientious, you know, you're very likely to pay your mortgage, or you could be somebody who's income, you could be a shit borrower, to be honest. It could be that. So you get a whole bunch of these mortgages and you package them up. And the best stuff, the best mortgage lendees go in the first tranche of this product, the senior tranche, AAA rated. So bond rating agencies, will look at the mortgage product that you put together, a bundle of mortgages, and you know, the package will be this, and the deal will be basically, okay, this package contains really good mortgages, probably okay mortgages and dodgy mortgages. And you can choose which tier of this product you want to invest in. So the senior tranche, the mezzanine tranche, and the equity tranche. Now, the way it works is the yield gets higher the lower quality you go, because you're taking more risk. If you want to take less risk, you just buy the senior tranche. And these guys, when income comes in from wherever it's coming in, senior tranche always gets paid out first. And then once they've been paid, mezzanine tranche gets paid out, and then equity tranche gets paid out. Okay, right, makes perfect sense. Collateralized debt obligations, a little bit trickier. So we're going to need Margot again to help out. So what that did is, okay, let's say you've launched your mortgage-backed security, and you've sold out of the senior tranche, because the type of people who buy fixed income products, they like the scene, they don't like risk, but they do like income. So that sells out. And only a bit of your mezzanine sells out, none of your equity tranche sells out. Well, what are you going to do with it then? Well, what you can do is you can basically take the stuff that didn't sell and you can repackage it into a new product, into a collateralized debt obligation. Thank you, Margot, for helping. So this was normally loads and loads of mezzanine tranche. But if we take a whole lot of them, so there's lots of them in a new product, well, now we are, and this is the clever bit, diversified. And that reduces risk. If you have been trained by the books in finance, diversification lowers your risk. So if you take a whole load of shit, but there's a lot of shit, now it's good shit. Hope that makes sense. So then you've got a new collateralized debt obligation. And now the senior tranche of this is made up of the middle tranche of the previous lot, but just more of it. And that gets a AAA rating. And now the insurance companies and the pension providers and the foreign governments or whatever who are looking to buy this product don't drill down right down to the underlying level. They just look at the rating and say, oh, look, senior tranche, AAA rated. Yeah, I'll have some of that. So that then goes in. And then you've still got the lower tranche of this, except the lower tranches of this really are absolutely toxic, bad shit. Now we need to get into credit default swaps. This is going to be the most complicated bit. So I needed Margot completely nude for this. We've added a couple of the Lotus Eater stickers just because it was a little bit raunchy. Well, I suppose she's not complete. She's got stocking on, but stockings don't cover anything important, so that's fine. It works for this purpose. Right, credit default swaps. What's going on with this? you can buy insurance on your car, right? And that is if you have an accident, you will be made whole on the cost of repairing your car. Right, but what if you could buy insurance on somebody else crashing their car. That's kind of it. So a credit default shop is basically just insurance. And normally you would buy this insurance if you held the underlying bond. But actually they are tradable. So you don't have to hold the underlying bond. You don't have to use it for its original intended purpose. You can just take a view that I think that such and such a thing is a bit suspicious, and therefore I'm going to do it. Now, credit default swaps on mortgages is not a thing until we get into our characters. When we get to Michael Berry, we're going to talk about how he sort of effectively created this market. It didn't exist, but credit default swaps will exist on things like government debt and corporate debt and a whole bunch of stuff. So this was a well-established product. And here's where it gets clever, you see, because it's insurance, the cost of insurance is linked to how risky a thing is perceived to be. So look, I've got the tranches up here on my little slide. And at the bottom there, we've got the senior tranche. Now, let's say you are going to deploy 50 million of your capital to buy insurance. If you are buying insurance on something extremely safe, then the insurance is not going to cost you very much, right? So your 50 million of insurance buy could get you a notional cover of billions. So your likely payout could very well be billions, because you're insuring something that is supposed to be safe and not going to need the insurance, and therefore they sell the insurance to you cheaply. Whereas up at the equity level, the chances of them having to pay out is a lot higher, and therefore your 50 million buy gets you a notional smaller level of coverage. You know, just like if you're a 17-year-old boy racer driver, your insurance is going to cost you more than if you're a very safe, sensible, you know, Miss Daisy or something. You know, you're going to pay a lot less for your insurance. This will be key later on when we get into the characters, which I think is about our time. Right. So, having explained how all of that works, we now need to talk about our first character, Michael Berry. Now, he was a clever chap. He was a former neurologist, I think it was. Self-taught investor. He founded Scion Capital, it was, in 2000. He did it with family money and personal funds. Was very successful, and he started to attract additional capital. Other people came on board. He was a deep value investor, so a Warren Buffett-style investor. And by 2004, after only being in business for a few years, he had $600 million under management. The way that these hedge funds work is a very attractive model. You get is what's called the 2-in-20 model. You basically get 2% of whatever it is you're managing every year as a fee, and then if you outperform, you get 20% of the upside. So it's a very attractive model. Now, in 2005, he started looking at the prospectuses for the mortgage loans, for the mortgage-backed securities. It actually started just sitting there and reading through them. Must have taken him a very long time. He read all the small print, and he started to realise that these things were nowhere near as high quality as they were supposed to be, especially the CDOs, the collateralised debt. You know, that they the bundles of mortgages. The what was in the bundles wasn't that good. Now, I think maybe at this point, we need to sort of play our... Oh, I need to put my earpiece in. We need to play our first clip to get at what is going on. So let's play this.
Matter of time before someone else sees this investment. We have to act now.
How do you know the bonds are worthless? Aren't they filled with fucking thousands of
pages of mortgages?
I read them.
You read them?
I read, yeah.
No one reads them. Only the lawyers who put them together read them.
I don't think that they even know what they've made. The housing market is propped up on these bad loans. It's a time bomb, and I want to short it.
Through what instrument, Michael? There are no insurance contracts or options for mortgage bonds. The bonds are too stable.
Lawrence, this is what I'm going to do. I am going to get a bank to make me one. And then I'm going to buy it.
Right, okay. So what's happening there? He's gone through these mortgage agreements. He's realized that they're bad, they're full of trash. And actually, the key thing that he realized is that a large number of these loans in there were not only subprime, what we now call shit mortgages, but they were adjustable rate mortgages, meaning that you started with a teaser trailer and then the rate went up quite significantly after that. And the people who were buying these subprime mortgages could probably afford the teaser trailer, but they definitely couldn't afford it when it adjusts. And because we had got into bubble territory, more and more of these mortgages had been sold, there was going to be a big glut of people who had to refinance in 2007 once the teaser trailer rolls off, and then it was going to lead to a glut in supply in the housing market. And that the mortgage-backed securities were basically going to go bad. 2007, 2008, there was going to be a huge amount of these adjustable loans rolling over. He realized that many borrowers had no income verification, no assets. Was it ninja loans, they call them? No income, no job. Can't remember what the A was now. And the loan to value ratio were ridiculously high. I mean, sometimes, you know, more than 100%. So he realized that the default rates were going to rise dramatically, and that the MBSs built on these loans and these CDOs built on these loans would implode. Basically, he understood that the borrowers were never going to be able to repay, and it wasn't a probability, it was a certainty. But in order to get there, you had to do a lot of work, and most people just don't do that, but he did. So he was in the situation of having to try and explain to his investors, you know, why is he doing this? And that is a consistent problem that he has in this movie, that he isn't able to communicate what he's doing to his investors that leads to all sorts of problems. And it's also really interesting how he was able to do this, because as his investor said in the video that we just watched, nobody offers credit default swaps on this market because it's considered too stable. That didn't slow him down. He was a Wall Street insider. He had a big fund, respectable name. So he basically just went to Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank and so on and said, I want you to create a market, explain what he wanted to do. And their team of lawyers and product engineers went together and they put together something because he wanted to put 100 million on this. So that was enough for them to go. And normally the way it works in banks is you've got a whole bunch of salespeople who are flogging stuff, but every so often they have a new idea for something where they can sell, and they create that product and then they go around and ship it. But in Michael Berry's case, he came to them and said, look, if this product were to be created, I would buy it and I'd buy a lot of it. And so their people went to work and they put together the product, and he told them which mortgage bonds specifically he wanted to take out a credit default swap insurance against. If they went bad, this would pay off. And he was focusing on, a bunch of, 2005, 2006 vintage mortgage-backed securities, which were heavy on adjustable rate mortgages. So they were going to tick up in 2007, 2008, and focus mainly on California and Florida, which were the most bubbly bits in his view. And so they went away and they created this product. Now, the credit default swaps that these banks came back with had a 5-year maturity on them. So, you know, this has got to pay out in 5 years or it goes away. Furthermore, the notional that the what it would pay out was going to be $1.3 billion, which is a lot. But here's the catch. Just like if you buy car insurance, you have to pay an annual premium. And these CDSs, this insurance, came with an annual premium. And he was having to spend something like 80 to 100 million a year on paying these insurance premiums for something that had never happened. The ability to short the housing market didn't exist until he created it. So he really is the one who should get most of the credit for this story. Right. But his investors are looking at this and thinking, well, this is mad. You're betting on something. They haven't done the work, remember. Their money is tied up in this fund. He's betting on something that's never happened, and the premiums he's paying is going to wipe out the fund in fairly short order if the thing that never happens doesn't happen fairly imminently. And that led to, I think this scene is probably the next one to watch, when two of his big investors march into his office and demand an explanation.
I have no confidence in your ability to identify macroeconomic trends.
You flew here to tell me that? Why? Anyone can see that there's a real estate bubble.
Actually, no one can see a bubble. That's what makes it a bubble.
That's dumb, Lawrence. It's always markers. Mortgage fraud was quintupled since 2000, and the average take-home pay is flat, but home prices are soaring. That means the homes are debt, not assets.
So Mike Burry of San Jose, a guy who gets his hair cut at Supercuts and doesn't wear shoes, knows more than Alan Greenspan and Hank Paulson.
Oh, yeah, Dr. Mike Burry. Yes, he does.
I mean, he's getting to the heart of it. He's done the work. He understands that this is a genuine thing. But most people are operating, his investors are financially sophisticated guys. They're operating in the swamp. You know, they're operating in a world where this simply doesn't happen. You know, the fish can't see the water it's swimming in. These guys can't see the problem. I got a lot of sympathy with Berry here. I feel the same way about Bitcoin, to be honest. I know the financial system is broken, and it is only a matter of time until something quite nasty happens, and therefore I want my insurance. So for me, Bitcoin does not feel like a speculative bet at all. I know this is going to happen. The difference with Bitcoin is lots more people see it now, especially post-2008, a lot more people see it. But there's still plenty of established financial people who just cannot see that the set of economic rules that we're working under are ever going to change. And that was also the case with his investors here. Let's play a bit more.
That's cute. Are you being sarcastic with us, Mike?
Lawrence, I don't know how to be sarcastic. I don't know how to be funny. I don't know how to work people. I just know how to read numbers.
How big's your short position right now?
Just the $1.3 billion.
And the premiums?
Well, we pay roughly 80 to 90 million each year, which is high, but I was the first to do this trade. Watch, it will pay. I may have been early, but I'm not wrong.
So his investors got legitimate concerns here. He's got a large short position. Now, traditionally, with a short position, let's say you're going short on an equity, that's very dangerous, because if you go short an equity, you're betting that the price will go down. And if the price of the equity goes up, then your short can lose an infinite amount of money, because shorts are more dangerous than long positions, because with a long position, the most you can ever lose is 100%, unless you've geared up, unless you've levered up, you're on the bubble. But normally, if you buy an equity, you can only lose 100%. With a short, you can lose infinity percent if the price keeps on rising, because there's no upper limit on price, and therefore your short, which is the inverse of that, which is your position, can go down infinitely. And what his investors here has asked him is, okay, how large is your position, and what's your monthly premium? And he's quickly seen that the premiums alone are going to wipe out the fund in about 5 years, maybe a bit less. Let's play a bit more.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing, Mike.
You're managing a...
Okay, let's also comment on that. He says, I'm not wrong, I'm early. And the other investor says, it's the same thing. Okay, yes, this is also very true. You can be right about something, but if you're right too early, you're basically wrong.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to chumbacasino.com.
Chumbacasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.